Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Oxford Policy Podcast. I'm Ksenia Velichko, a Master Public Policy candidate at the Blavatnik School of Government, and I'm joined with my fellow MPP colleague and friend, Eric Kucherenko.
Hi, everyone.
Today, we are honored to have renowned Ukrainian human rights activist and Nobel Peace Prize winner Oleksandra Matvichuk with us. Oleksandra leads the Center for Civic Liberties, a human rights organization based in Kyiv. Her effort stands as proof that civilians are not just victims of war, they can be agents of peace and justice. In 2023, Oleksandra achieved global recognition by being included in Time magazine's list of the 100 most influential people of 2023. Oleksandra, welcome.
Thank you for the invitation.
Oleksandra, could you please just for the start tell our audience more about your work in the Center for Civil Liberties and how your mission helps promote human rights in Ukraine and worldwide?
For the last 10 years, we with the Center for Civil Liberties have been documenting war crimes in this war which Russia started against Ukraine. Russian troops deliberately shell in residential buildings, schools, churches, hospitals, and museums. They are attacking evacuation corridors. They torturing people in filtration camps. They forcibly taking Ukrainian children to Russia. They are robbing, raping, killing civilians in the occupied territories. And we document not just violations of Geneva and Hague conventions, we record human pain so that sooner or later, all people who commit these crimes, as well as Putin and top political leadership and high military command of Russian state, will be held accountable.
Mm-hmm. Do you cooperate with international institutions, perhaps international judicial tribunals like International Criminal Court? Do you submit your evidence to them?
When large-scale invasion started, we united our efforts with dozens of organizations in regions and built a national network of documentators. We have an ambitious goal to document each criminal episode which was committed in the smallest settlement in each oblast in Ukraine. Mm. And working together, we jointly documented more than 62,000 episodes of war crimes. And this is a fact of committing crimes. And that is why we are closely cooperating with all national and international institutions who provide further investigations, like International Criminal Court, International Commission on Inquiry, which was created by UN Council on Human Rights, Moscow mechanisms of OSCE, and national legislations and legal enforcement bodies. Hmm.
Oleksandra, in your opinion, why do the organization which you lead, and you in particular, won the Nobel Peace Prize? What is there in particular? What differ you from other organizations?
It's a good question because it was a huge surprise for us. Like, we are ordinary human rights lawyers. We are not celebrities. We never even dreamed that we can receive a Nobel Peace Prize and had no idea that someone nominate us to this award. I think that not because we are best of others, but because now we are work in justice field. And this is something which is express and symbolize needs of millions of people in Ukraine. What do I mean? In October 2022, the All-Ukrainian survey was conducted and people were asked, what will be the main disappointment for you when the war will end? And 65% of people answered that the main disappointment for them will be impunity for Russian war crimes. So now we symbolize this demand of million people for justice.
Mm. In view of your experience, how do you see overall the role of civil society organizations in the way society develops? How has your work in civil society sector actually influenced the way Ukrainian society developed in these last 2 years and maybe even beyond before the full-scale invasion, the start of the Russian aggression?
The role of civil society is extremely important everywhere, but especially in the countries which have no luxury to have a sustainable and well-developed state institutions. And the role of civil society become extremely important in the process of transformation. In Ukraine, this nation in transit, we are going through the Soviet past to the well-developed democracy, which means that it's not enough to adopt the qualities, laws, and build formal institutions, because values of society is always prevail, and values of society provides the energy to drive this laws and institutions properly work in the right way. So that is why the power of active citizens in such historical period are so important, because values is not just what you tell, it's more about what you do and what decisions you are taking.
Hmm. Do you think that Ukrainian civil society is sufficiently active to achieve this transition towards fully fledged democracy and towards European future?
We do our best, but look, we are in large scale war. And now we have to make this pass of the integration process in the circumstances in which no one current member of European Union had faced. Because large scale war and democratization, it's different opposite processes. Large scale war needs centralization. Democratization need decentralization. Large-scale war means that you have to limit rights and freedom due to security requirements, but democratization means that you have to expand the space for rights and freedom. So now we have to do our best and be very creative to find a balance between these two needs, security and freedom, and to show the success on the way of Euro integration. It's not easy task, so you can wish us good luck.
Yeah. Let's delve into the process. So your organization has been instrumental in documenting war crimes in Ukraine. Could you share some insight into this process and its impact?
We work a lot on developing the national legislation in Ukraine. Let me return to the fields of combating with impunity for war crimes. There are a lot of things which Ukraine has to do by itself. What do I mean? We have a lot of reports of international organizations who stated that Russians commit crimes against humanity in Ukraine. But we have a zero criminal proceedings opened on the fact of crimes against humanity, because we have no article in criminal court which provides responsibility for such actions. This is a very weird situation that we have crimes but can't prosecute and name these crimes properly. And several years ago, our organization initiated the draft of law which solved this and others' problems in criminal court. And we organized a huge advocacy campaign to convince parliament to adopt this law. This law was adopted and sent to president's office, and unfortunately, it's still there. So the problem is not solved, and we hope that it will be solved sooner than later.
Mm. Do you also work with authorities trying to advocate for the ratification of the Rome Statute in Ukraine?
Yes, and we were the first who formulated this as a demand to power. It was in February 2014, immediately after the Revolution of Dignity, because during the Revolution of Dignity, I was coordinator of civil initiative Euromaidan SOS, and we brought up thousands of people to provide legal and other assistance to persecuted protesters. We worked 24 hours a day, and hundreds and hundreds of people every day passed through our care. People who were beaten, arrested, tortured, accused in fabricated criminal or administrative charges. And we formulated this demand because we want to have a guarantee that in future, regardless of power, regardless of party who win the election, regardless of the political ideology or colors, nobody will take a decision to disperse peaceful student demonstrations or to gunning down peaceful people in Maidan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and apparently now when ratification of the Rome Statute is one of the requirements on our way to the European Union, and it was already in the accession agreement, do you assess that it can be ratified anytime soon? What would be your expectation?
It's not an easy task. In 2016, we organized a campaign to push our authorities to change constitution. And because of this campaign, they added one sentence in Article 124, and it's provide a legal way to ratification of Rome Statute. But also, our authorities ingrained in this changes of constitution the provision that this concrete norm will be entered into force only after 3 year delay. But now this 3 year delay passed, but we're still there, and probably we have to do a lot to achieve this goal.
Right. But that being said, actually, Ukraine did submit a declaration that authorized the ICC to prosecute war crimes committed now in Ukraine. At the same time, the ICC cannot prosecute the crime of aggression committed by the Russian Federation against Ukraine. And this is why you've been campaigning for the creation of a separate, special, ad hoc international criminal tribunal specifically for one crime, the crime of aggression against Ukraine. Could you please tell us more about how this idea appeared and how you became engaged in its advocacy?
As a lawyer, when we face with unprecedented number of Russian war crimes, I start to ask myself, for whom do we document all these crimes for? Because I understood that we faced with accountability gap, and this accountability gap has several dimensions. Now we speak about one of this dimension, the situation when there is no international court which can prosecute Putin, Lukashenko, and their surrounding for the crime of aggression. And this is extremely important because all other atrocities which we're now documenting, it's results of their leadership decision of responsible persons to initiate, to plan, and to start this war. And it's a very common logic that if we want to prevent wars in future, we have clearly sent a signal that we will punish states and authoritarian leaders who start such wars. But even regardless that it's very common sense, in the whole history of humankind, we have only one precedent when authoritarian leaders were punished for the aggressive wars, and it was Nuremberg trials in the last century. So we have to create this court in the form of international tribunal because we have to have a competence to overcome immunities with Putin has according international law. And we have to do it now without waiting when and how the war will end. And here I will be very honest. We have 40 countries who discussed this idea, but still no consensus, which means that we a little bit lack of bravery and historical responsibility of political leaders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In 3 weeks, we will commemorate the second anniversary of the full-scale invasion and the 10th anniversary of the Russian aggression against Ukraine, which started in 2014 with the unlawful annexation of Crimea. The war is only intensifying. Russia continues attack on the front line and sends thousands of missiles and drones every day on Ukrainian civilians. While the situation is so unpredictable, what are your expectations from 2024 and from the nearest future? Do you see any timelines, key milestones to watch that will define how things will develop?
It's difficult to predict future, even the nearest future. And I'm a person who not try to predict, but try to create future, which we want with my own efforts. And I think that one of the main tasks which we have to complete in the nearest future is to set the common goals with the international community. Because when large-scale invasion started, the civilized world told, let's help Ukraine not to fail. And Ukraine obtained the first weapons to be able to defend ourselves, and first real sanctions against Russia were introduced into force. And we're extremely grateful because it helped us to survive. It's very difficult to fight with Russians with bare hands. But it's also an explanation why we was waiting for a first modern tank for more than 1 year. Why we had to start counteroffensive without zero modern plane. And we're still waiting. Because the goal, let's help Ukraine not to fail, is not the same goal as let's help Ukraine to win. And there is a huge difference between these two goals. And we can practically measure these differences in types of weapons, in speed of decisions, and gravity of sanctions. And I think it's one of the important issues for the next months.
Why do you think the West is hesitant to actually turn to this more forward-looking mode of helping Ukraine win?
I will remind that I'm human rights lawyer, not politicians and not diplomats. But my hypothesis is that when we speak about Ukrainian victory, if Ukraine has to win, it means that Russia has to lose. And the international community has no strategy what to do with Russia if Russia losing. And this lack of vision converted in lack of actions. And this is very responsible from my point of view, because you can't stop history. Soviet Union collapsed regardless whether or not the West was prepared for this and had a strategy. We remember how a president of America came to Kiev in 19th and made this famous in Ukraine chicken speech, and he asked Ukrainians not to proclaim independent state because the political elites in the West were afraid what will be if Soviet Union collapse. But it happened. And Russia will be defeated sooner or later. Putin will lose. It's inevitable, and it's better to be prepared.
Right. You touched upon a very important topic, that now the attention that the whole world has been paying to Ukraine for these last 2 years has gradually faded away. In a way, we see that there are delays in approving support in the US. Thankfully, today, just in the morning, the European Union has approved its new 50 billion euro support package. But still, we see these problems because the world, so much is happening in the world. So my question is, how actually can we try to maintain world's attention to what is happening in Ukraine, because the war hasn't stopped? And what does the Center for Civil Liberty do in this respect?
Probably, if I can find simple answer to this very complex question, I will formulate these answers in two different messages for two different audiences. First, for Ukrainians, we have to find a way how to decrease our dependency on the international assistance, because it's very sensitive and fragile position. We have to be creative. If we want to survive, we have to find a way to return breath to local economy. I know very well how it's difficult because we document war crimes, and I know how my native country is destroyed deliberately by Russians, and also we lost millions of people who became refugees, and a lot of people who can be involved in the process of recovering joined Ukraine Armed Forces, and now with the arms defending our freedom and human dignity, but still we have no other choice. So it's our responsibility, and we have to succeed. And second message will be to international community, because it's not just Ukrainian war. This war is not just a war between two states. This is a war between two systems, authoritarianism and democracy. And we live in a world where the 80% of people live in a non-free or partial free society. We see how the authoritarian coalition is formed, like Syria voted for Russia in UN, North Korea provide Russia with more than a million artillery shell, China helped to bypass the sanctions, Iran provides Russia with drones. So it's a civilization battle, and freedom in all the world is in danger. And you can hide from these challenges inside borders, because there are a lot of things which have no limitation in borders. And it's not just from value and human a point, but practically important to support Ukraine, because if he'll not be able to stop Putin in Ukraine, he will go further, even more. It will encourage other authoritarian leaders in different parts of the world to do the same.
I've watched some of your interviews and read articles, and totally share your vision that this war has genocide features. While working and documenting war crimes, can you share with our listeners which genocide features do you see, why this war is genocide?
Well, let me first express why I think so. Because as a lawyer, I know that genocide is a crime of crimes. It's very difficult to prove the genocide, especially taking into account that when we speak about legal term, it's not compose all dimensions which Raphael Lemkin, the creator of this concept, ingrained in this concept. But from the common logic, if you want to destroy completely or partially some national group, there is no necessity for you to kill all representatives of this national group. You can forcibly change their identity, and the national group will disappear. And this is something which we observe on different levels, from starting of official rhetorics of Putin and top politicians of Russia, who said that there is no Ukrainian nation, we are the same people as Russians, there is no Ukrainian language, the Ukrainian culture is not exist. Then if you know Russian language, you can follow how this interpret on the Russian TV and Russian propagandists openly said that Ukrainians have to be either re-educated as Russians or killed. And then we document how this verbal messages converted into horrible reality. Because Ukraine language is banned on occupied territories. People can be killed and tortured to death just for having Ukrainian flag in their home. Russians deliberately exterminate local elites. I don't mean just politicians or mayors. It's journalists, children writers, priests, volunteers, like active people of community who help to preserve this community as such. Even if we speak about such crime as forcible deportation of Ukrainian children to Russia, let's remind that these children first spent in Russian re-education camps, where they was told that they are Russians, not Ukrainian children, and then they are forcibly adopted by Russian family and brought up as Russians. So it's a whole well-organized genocidical policy. And I, as a lawyer, I know that law is dynamic material and has to be changed, and in order to be effective in the concrete context.
I think it's actually very pertinent that you mentioned the deportation of children is one of the features that is very indicative of the genocidal nature of the Russian aggression, because hundreds of thousands of children were deported. And perhaps you must be very much engaged in investigating and tracing this process. Is it difficult to work with this issue, and how do you mentally cope with such a complicated domain of your work?
Frankly speaking, it's not easy because, as I mentioned before, we are documenting human pain. And while I'm looking to my phone, I would like to provide you example of stories which we're documenting. And this is a story of Ilya Matviyenko, a 10-year-old boy from Mariupol. When Russian troops surrounding Mariupol, they refused to provide permission for International Committee of Red Cross to evacuate civilians from there. And Ilya and his mother has to hide in the basement of their house because of indiscriminate Russian shellings. And they melted snow to get water and to make fires to make some cook. But then the food was gone and they have to return to apartment. And suppose in this time they appeared in the center of new Russian shellings. And his mother was wounded in her head and the boy's legs was torn. With the last of her strength, his mother dragged her son to a friend's apartment, and there was no medical assistance for the time in the city because prior to this, Russians destroyed a maternity hospital and the whole medical infrastructure in Mariupol. And so in apartment, they lay down on the couch and just hugged each other. And they were lying like this for several hours. And Ilya told to my colleague that his mother died and froze right in his arms. When you have 62,000 of such stories, for sure it has a huge impact for you. Like,
yeah. That's true. I think that it's very brave of you that you continue working with that, because perhaps you are motivated by something that is higher and that you really like, that makes all these efforts pay off.
At least two things provide me strength. First, I strongly believe that all other efforts have sense. And in a time of turbulence, when you can't rely on legal instruments, you can always rely on people. And this is the second things which motivate me. Let me describe these two things more broadly. If we return to the history, which is important for me because I was brought up in the circle of Soviet dissidents, if we try to relate their success from the short term, we can say that their efforts have no sense, because dissidents' movement in the Soviet Union was repressed very severely. People were killed, people were subjected to forcible psychological treatment, people were jailed in Soviet Gulag, all of them lost their career, their families was ruined. From the short perspective, they has no success, but from the long-term perspective, now in 2024, we know for sure that we got independence and restore our independence only because they had a bravery, stood up against the whole totalitarian Soviet machine in 16. Mm. Which means that in long-term perspective, they win. And return to the second things which helped me, it's example of ordinary people. When large-scale invasion started, the international organizations evacuated their personnel. And ordinary people remained. And ordinary people started to do extraordinary things. Like the brother of my colleague, who for that time worked in Germany and immediately returned to Ukraine, and start to evacuate civilians from the siege cities. And his evacuation column was deliberately shelled by Russian. Many people were killed and he was severely injured. His colleagues from Germany transferred him for treatment in Germany. And he's still there. He is still in process of recovering. He lost his legs. And here, his sister, my colleague, told me very frankly that as a sister, she thinks that she don't want her brother to return from the safe Germany when large-scale invasion started and to do such dangerous work. But there is one important moment. One family which survived because of her brother's efforts has a small boy. His name is Dmytryk. And this boy, he regularly write some inspiring messages to her brother and always thank him for their survival. And she told me that I know this, that I want to avoid this destiny for my brother, but I'm so happy that my brother saved this child.
Wow.
Are there any specific projects or initiatives of the Center for Civic Liberties is currently working on which you would like to highlight?
I would like to highlight our fight for justice because it's not just our fight. I remember that in first days of large-scale invasion, I got a letter from our Syrian colleagues, human rights defenders, and they wrote me, "Your fight, it's our fight. Please tell me how we can help you, because your success will be our success." In our world, in different parts of the globe, there are many people who fight for freedom and human dignity in unbelievable circumstances. And we have so much failures, so we need success of Ukraine, not just for Ukrainians, but to create a precedent that it's possible and to inspire people to continue their fight.
Sandra, thank you so much for this such an emotional, a powerful and inspirational conversation. I'm sure that our listeners from all over the world have been just inspired by your example, but also by the work that you are doing. And the messages that you've communicated to us, that's certainly very important. And as we enter 2024, with so much instability in the world and with so much going on, I'm sure that the values that you are carrying and that you are disseminating are certainly something that binds us together as a humanity. So I would like to thank you for your time. And Xenia.
Yes, and as we continue our journey in Oxford, and we are starting here to create a world better led, better served, and better governed. Thank you for this talk. Thank you for inspiring us. And we hope and we wish glory to Ukraine, glory to our heroes. And see you next time.
Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Thank you.